on them, but they didn't kill them.
Expand, said Eisenhorn. Ursids kill people, said Drusha, especially the smaller, more aggressive Ursa Minora, but they don't hunt them for food. An Ursid kills a man because they meet by accident. The Ursid reacts in surprise or in defense of young. It kills swiftly.
Yeah, then it feeds, said Max.
Sometimes, Drusha replied. Ursids are omnivorous. They will eat flesh, meat of any sort, actually, even human. One might encounter a man, kill him, then feed. Or it might feed on a body if it finds one. But human flesh is not a regular part of its diet. It does not seek it out.
But a rogue animal, said Max, one that's got a taste for it. I mean, a taste for human flesh.
That happens, doesn't it? You once told me that.
It does, said Drusha. It's very rare. The man-eater syndrome. Often a diseased or wounded animal, one whose aggression is compounded, multiplied.
So a rogue animal did this?
Asked Nail.
Again, no, said Drusha.
You can tell that without even looking? Asked Nail.
You can compare bite prints or something, suggested Max.
I can tell it by counting, said Drusha. 18 bodies. 15 male, 3 female. Perhaps more to come. In a period of a year or two.
How many Ursids are there in the Carinines?
Nail and Max looked at each other.
I'll tell you, Drusha began.
Population sparse, said Audler Jaff suddenly. As with all major carnivores or apex predators, an Ursid's average feeding ground is 300 square kilometers, slightly more for Minora. When young are present, the range increases. Thus we might calculate the distributed population of the region by taking the overall size of the area and dividing by an averaged figure of 300. Thus, about 130.
Very good, said Drusha.
130 Ursids in these woods, said Nail.
In this province, corrected Drusha. Actually, I was allowing for the entire run of the Carinine Belt, said Jaff.
I don't get it, said Max. 130. That's a lot of Ursids.
Drusha looked at Jaff. How much does an adult Ursid consume in a year, ma'am?
As much as it can, she replied. But conservatively, 3 times its body weight.
You see, said Drusha.
One Ursid would not have killed and eaten 18-plus human beings.
Hang on, said Nail. You just said 130 of them.
As a total distributed population, said Drusha, we might attribute 1 or perhaps 2 deaths in a 5-year period to accidental encounter and misadventure. Or we might explain multiple deaths to the action of a rogue animal, a man-eater, which, as I mentioned, is an extremely rare phenomenon. So a man-eater might have, and I stress it's unlikely, killed 18 poor souls. But he would not have eaten them all. That's simply too much food, even for a large and aggressive Ursid.
Eisenhorn looked at him, steadily.
Interesting, he said.
Preliminary, said Drusha.
Then go beyond preliminary. What do you think killed them?
Something else, said Drusha. If examination reveals Ursid feeding patterns, and I confidently expect it will be indicative of a non-frenzied pattern, then we might surmise that the local Ursid population devoured found corpses. But they did not make the kills.
Well, surely, said Max, other Ursids could have found and fed upon kills made by the rogue animal. You said it couldn't eat them all itself.
That's possible, but again, unlikely, said Drusha. It's a matter of territory. Minora are fiercely territorial. But let's take a look.
He walked over to the nearest gurney.
Do you have any oil of arsakil?
Asked Max, holding out a small pot.
I was going to say true heart, he replied.
Don't be smart, she said, but grinned.
Arsakil or nothing.
He took the pot, smeared some under his nose, and unzipped the bag. He stared for a moment.
Gonna throw up? Max asked.
No, he said. He took off his spectacles and began to fiddle with them.
I just want to be able to see straight.
Audler Jaff casually took the spectacles out of his hands and performed 3 quick, deft twists. She reached up and put them back on his nose, gently. They sat perfectly straight. Drusha blinked.
Goodness me, he said. Keep going, Magos,
Jaff whispered as she stepped back.
You're impressing him.
Drusha plucked a pair of surgical gloves from a carton, put them on, and picked up a stainless steel probe from a tray. He hunched down and began to examine the exposed corpse.
It was little more than a skeleton, blackened with old blood and tatters of congealed tissue. There is some indication of an ursid feeding pattern. Tooth marks on the ribs here. If I can get a cast, I can confirm. Do you have an electromacroscope?
Yes,
said Eisenhorn. Then I can provide a comparative for you in a couple of hours. A side-by-side of bite marks and dental impressions. I think it will confirm the feeding patterns of several individual ursids. It's not frenzied, just as I expected. They were scavenging. He looked up. Was there feeding residue at the sites? He asked. Feeding what? Asked Max. Residue. Ursids are not clean eaters. They will tear chunks off, scatter bones, ribs, the bones of extremities.
Some of the bodies were washed down by meltwater, said Eisenhorn, so we have no idea where they were killed.
But the ones that were found in situ, where you presume they were slain? No, said Max. No residue. That's odd, said Drusha.
Expand, said Eisenhorn.
It suggests those locations were not the scenes of the crimes, so to speak. It suggests the killing and perhaps even the feeding happened elsewhere. They were dump sites? Asked Max. They were dump sites, Drusha nodded.
That's criminal pathology, said Eisenhorn.
It is, agreed Drusha. Ursids may have grazed the kills and destroyed evidence. That might have been intentional. But the victims were killed elsewhere, then dumped. Add to that the extremely unlikely coincidence that all the victims cannot be identified on any local or planetary database. Even rogue ursid man-eaters do not select their prey on the basis of identity profiling, which means you're looking for human actors, Inquisitor. Men did this. This is serial execution, or serial murder. He looked at Eisenhorn. But you knew that already, didn't you? Drusha asked. Eisenhorn didn't reply. Then tell me, if you want me to work at optimum efficiency, said Drusha, what brought the Inquisition into this?
18 deaths,
said Nail, flatly.
No, said Drusha, still looking straight at Eisenhorn. That's a dreadful tally, but serial murder is still within the purview of the Marshal Division. There's something else. You have positively identified at least one of these bodies, haven't you? Long before you even got here.
Chapter 7 Spirits of Place. Drusha put on his coat, slung his satchel over his shoulder, and went for a walk. The rain had eased back, and the sky over the valley was a hazy blue. There was a woman at the fortress gate, a glum woman in magistratum gear. Her name badge read Edda, and she carried a riot gun.
"Where are you going, sir?" she asked.
"I need to examine a few things," Drusha replied. It seemed to him a better answer than, "I have to get away from these people for a while."
"Have you been given permission to exit?" she asked.
"Of course I have," he lied. No one had said anything to him about anything. After his assessment of the bodies in the cold store, Drusha felt as though he might have crossed a line. Eisenhorn had said nothing, except to send them all out of the room. Drusha wasn't sure if he'd revealed truths that had given the Inquisitor new things to ponder, or if he'd exposed some secrets Eisenhorn had been keeping to himself. Had he impressed Eisenhorn into silence, or aggravated him? Eisenhorn was impossible to read. He didn't appear to express any nuance of reaction, except a grim glare. Deputy Edda looked at Drusha for a moment, then sighed and unlocked the gates. From the fortress gates, the fortress track ran down the valley through a thick brake of trees. Drusha followed it for a while, then left the path and followed the slope of the valley deeper into the forest. He began to relax. The air was clean and cool, and the scent of pine resin gave it a menthol tang. Sunlight shone through the tall, close-packed evergreens. The rolling forest bed was flaxweed, deep green hellebore, thistle, eyewort, and banks of antipodes that brushed around his shins. Climbing tracery hung in gauze mantles around lower branches. He saw the meaty combs of blaxiform fungi sprouting from rotting bark, the white cushions of belly-capped toadstools in the weeds, processions of sennet ants marching vertically up tree trunks, leaves and fat white grubs carried aloft in their jaws like trophies and banners. The air smelled of wet loam, camphor, and flower scent. Fat pollinator insects buzzed past. Invisible beetles clicked and chirred in the undergrowth. He heard the cooing warble of the wood dove, Astroverdus, and watched tiny brown seed finches dart and snap through the lower branches. By the time he reached the stream, the fortress long since out of sight behind him, he had his notebook out and his old spotting magnoculars around his neck. He'd seen and noted redbeaks, 4 different types of arboreal warbler, 2 root hens, still dowdy in the last of their winter plumage as they stalked nervously through the ground cover, and a mountain hawk. The hawk had been quite distant. He'd glimpsed it in a patch of sky, framed through the emerald canopy, turning silently on the thermals over the lower valley. Destrus aquilus gershomi, the little hill hawk. He'd noted another 16 avian species just from call and song. The gurgling stream was a meltwater rill that followed the contour of the slope, breaking and sharply plunging over clefts and mossy boulders. He followed its course, and the deeper sound of splashing as it fast fed a pool somewhere ahead. He watched for tracks in the mud, for ursid spore, but the heavy rain had been too recent. He reached the pool. It was overhung on the rising side by huge blocks of tumble-down stone, swathed in moss. 3 different streams fed the pool, the sparkling rush of their flow producing constant intersecting ripple patterns across its surface. The skin of the water was also wiggling with hookfly larvae. Drusha climbed onto the overlooking stones and sat down to watch tiny fawn darters skim and hunt the larvae. There was a decent view. He could look out across the forest banks below, the dense stands of evergreens, and see the dark, sharp mass of the Carinine peaks that formed the opposite side of the high valley, 40 kilometers away, through the early afternoon haze. He sketched the pool for a while, then the view. He sat patiently still for 5 minutes, with no sound except birdsong and the burble of the streams, as a timid crop-horn deer came to drink. He noticed that, despite extensive weathering, the stone blocks he was perched on had traces of hard edges. They had been worked. The remains of some building or wall, perhaps a watchtower guarding the lower approaches to Helter Fortress. A cold breeze rustled through the forest, and he felt the temperature drop. The sunlight diminished as clouds passed over. More rain coming, he surmised. He wasn't bothered. He was shaded by trees. The cool air was a welcome relief from the bright heat of the day, and it wasn't the first time he'd sat out in a downpour. Rain was honest. Drusha reflected that perhaps, more than anything else, that was why he had become a Magos biologist, to spend as much of his life as he could outside, in nature, whatever nature happened to be, with its simple cause-and-effect systems. It kept him away from the company of people, with their lies and secrets and agendas and games. That, or he simply wasn't very good at those sorts of interactions. The thoughtful smile faded slightly from his lips. He was no longer alone. There was a man sitting by the edge of the pool below him. Drusha had no idea how long the man had been there, but he doubted it was more than 5 minutes. Drusha had been lost in his own thoughts and the tranquility of the place, but he was surprised he hadn't noticed the man arrive. "Good afternoon," he called down. The man looked up and smiled. He looked pleasant enough. He had a round face and wore a good walking coat and laced boots. He was sketching in a large, green-covered book.
"I didn't see you there, sir," the man said.
Drusha clambered down. He got a glimpse of the man's sketch. It was a view of the valley, very finely done.
"I don't mean to disturb," said Drusha.
"Not at all. I was just out, ambling around," the man said.
He continued to sketch. "Are you a visitor?" Drusha asked.
"Oh, no. I live nearby,"
the man replied.
"You?"
"A visitor," said Drusha.
"Ah, well, it's that season,"
the man said. He paused to put a point back on his graphite stick with a little pocket knife.
"And this area is very pleasant. The Carinines in early summer. Wonderful air. Good for the spirit. I sometimes wonder if, when our ancestors first came to this world, they stopped here because it was so agreeable."
"It is indeed agreeable."
"And fought over it, of course."
Drusha frowned.
"Fought, sir?"
"You know, back in the past. The old tribes of Outer Udar coveting this region because it was so bounteous compared to their sparse homelands. There were wars in these mountains for centuries, all forgotten now.
I confess I don't know much about war, sir, said Drusha, perching on a rock near to where the man sat, or history. I am a student of science and nature, a Magos biologist. The man looked at him with interest.
Is that right? Sir, I envy you. That's a fine calling. As a boy, I wanted to become a naturalist, too. I won a place at Delkey, the Skolam there, to study the sciences of living worlds. But duty, you know. My family is in timber. My dear father, he needed a son with business acumen who could take over the trade, so I transferred to the Universitariate at Tycho. Had that not been fate's path, I might have been a Magos biologist myself.
But you still dabble? Asked Drusha.
Oh, yes,
the man said.
When I can get out of the office and away from invoices and shipment manifests and audits and labor disputes with the logging gangs, any spare moment you'll find me out here, away from it all.
You have a good hand, said Drusha, gesturing towards the sketch. The man looked down at his work and propped the sketch up in its green card cover to consider it.
Kind of you to say so, sir,
he replied.
I'm sure I lack your skills of observation and execution. Tell me, are you staying nearby?
Very close by, said Drusha.
You're not a friend of Sark's, are you?
Sark?
Draven Sark.
No, I don't know him. The man smiled and shrugged. Drusha found it hard to tell how old he was. He looked Drusha's age, but that meant little. So many people had juvenile treatment these days, those who could afford it. The man might have been 100 years old and not look a day over 40. Drusha had heard that recipients of juvenile work lived to ages of 170 sometimes.
Old Sark's a friend of mine,
the man said, returning to his sketch.
A neighbour. I only ask because you're the sort of interesting fellow he has as a guest. In the summer months, they come from all over, sometimes off-world. I'll tell you, the people I've met at his dinners over the years, scientists, scholars, merchants, artists, fleet officers. What does this Master Sark do?
Drusha asked. The man frowned.
Why, I've known him 30 years. Must be at least that. He was one of my father's friends to begin with. 30 years. And I confess I don't know exactly what it is he does. His background is science. Medical science. The old materia medica. But I think he's in investment now. Bulk cargo shipping. Mining. That sort of thing. I refer to him as my very wealthy neighbor. He lives in the old fortress.
You mean Helter? Asked Drusha. The man looked at him as if he'd made a joke.
No,
he said, gesturing vaguely.
Kestri, further down towards the pass, much older than Helter.
As I said, remarked Drusha with a smile, I don't know the history.
Oh, the Karanines are full of hill forts, ancient places. Many are lost now, of course. Some of them are very grand. Palaces, from the pre-Udaran age. Kestri is one of those.
Drusha nodded. Out here, alone, he said, are you not concerned about coming to harm?
From what?
The man asked. Ursid.
Oh, I see them from time to time. They don't bother you unless you're stupid. I'm sure you know that, being a student of nature. You don't seem to be afraid to be out here on your own.
As you say, said Drusha. I know what to do if I run across an Ursid. I just wondered. There have been some deaths recently. Ursid kills.
Really?
Asked the man.
I hadn't heard that.
Yes, of late.
Well, thanks for the advice. I'll keep an eye out. You know, though, one summer, it must be 4 or 5 years ago now, I was out sketching. Now, you were very kind enough to compliment my work, but I'm very slow. Like today, I can sit for hours before I produce anything halfway decent. So I'd been sitting for 3 hours, lost in it, and I looked up and, throne take me, there was a King Grey sitting right there, as close to me as you are now, just minding his business. Huge he was. So I just kept sketching. You know, no sudden movements. And he sat there for a while longer, then grunted and wandered off into the trees. Funniest thing.
You've been here a while today, then? Drusha asked. The man squinted up at the sun.
Oh, 2 hours at least before you came along.
Drusha hesitated. He was about to speak when he heard someone calling his name in the forests above them.
Someone is looking for me, he said.
The man put his sketchbook down and got up. He offered Drusha his hand.
Well, it was a pleasure to meet you, Magos, he said.
He listened for a second to the voice calling out from the trees.
Magos, Drusha, I believe.
Valentin, said Drusha, shaking the man's hand.
I'm Essek, the man said. Mind how you go, and watch out for those Ursids, eh?
Drusha wandered up the slope from the pool and saw Nail coming through the trees towards him. Nail looked aggravated. He was lugging a large, matte black las rifle.
What's the matter? Drusha asked.
Nail slithered to a halt on the mossy slope and glared at Drusha. He activated the vox set fixed to his collar.
I found him, he said. Stand down.
What's the problem? Drusha asked.
You left the fortress.
So?
You don't go out alone. Or without permission.
Why?
Asked Drusha.
That's what Eisenhorn instructed,
Nail snapped.
Besides, you must have realized it's not safe out here.
Safe from what? Asked Drusha.
Don't be difficult, said Nail. Come on, follow me back.
There's a man down there, Drusha said. It's odd, actually. He...
What man?
Asked Nail. Drusha turned to point. Down by the pool, there was no one at all. Chapter 8. After Life.
I just don't understand, Drusha kept saying.
Then stop trying, said Max. They were in the old kitchen of Helter Fortress, and she was brewing caffeine in a copper pot.
I suppose he could have wandered away when my back was turned, said Drusha. But he said he'd been there for hours, and that can't have been the case, because...
His voice trailed off. He realized he was chafing his upper arms with his hand, and was still wearing his coat.
It's so cold in here, he said.
It is, she agreed. He walked over to the sink. His breath was making steam in the air.
There's ice in the sink. Frost on the inside of the windows. Max,
we've been told to ignore it, she said.
Max, it's a warm day outside.
Is it? She asked wearily. She put 2 tin cups of caffeine on the old table. Drink, she said. Drusha peered up through the window. The sky was very dark and unsettled. It looked like evening setting in, but it was still mid-afternoon.
Is there a storm coming? He asked.
I guess there must be, said Max. He sat down, facing her.
What the hell's going on, Germaine? I walked out of the gates not 2 hours ago, and it was sunny and clear. Now I come back, and it's like midwinter.
She shrugged. She looked uneasy, and Germaine Max seldom appeared uneasy. There's stuff going on, and we're instructed not to ask questions, she said.
That's not really good enough, he replied.
It has to be for me, she said. This is my job. I'm assigned to assist.
Well, I'm not, he said. I think I've had enough of this. I think I might go.
She looked at him. Don't screw things up, Valentin, she said. They're offering you an off-world ticket, the thing you've always wanted.
Well, he began, I've done my part. I've done what I can.
Tell me about this man you met, she said.
It was just a man, out for a walk.
And he vanished?
No, of course he didn't. He must have walked off. It was nothing.
What did you talk about? She asked.
I don't know. The countryside. He was a local man. I think he said he was in the logging industry.
Did he have a name? Before he could answer, the kitchen door opened, and Vorier and Betancourt walked in.
"'We'd like to have a word with the Magos,' Warrior said to Max. She nodded, then realized it meant they were asking her to leave. Max got up, shot a look at Drusha, and walked out. Warrior sat down facing Drusha. Betancourt stood, leaning against the larder cupboards.
"'Let's start with instructions,' said Warrior. "'You follow them, Magos. You don't come and go as you please.'
"'I didn't know that,' said Drusha.
"'You do now,' said Warrior. "'So, that won't happen again, will it? Not now you know.'
"'It's for your safety, Valentin,' said Betancourt.
Drusha shrugged grudgingly. "'All right,' he said. "'But I don't like this very much at all.'
"'Now, about this man you met,'
said Warrior, ignoring the remark.
"'Tell me about him.'
"'I just went over this with Max,' Drusha said. "'He was just he said he lived locally. He knew the area. The way he talked, he knew the history. He ran a timber business, or his father did. I get the feeling he'd taken it over. That was it, really.
But you thought it was odd, said Betancourt.
Drusha turned to look at her.
Just in hindsight, really, ma'am, he said. I didn't see him approach in the first place. I just looked up, and there he was. And I didn't see him leave. But I'm sure that was just me.
You're a very observant man, said Warrior.
He put Drusha's notebook on the table and opened it.
You're a Magos biologist. It's part of the training. These notes you took today, they are a testament to an acute level of observation. Details of plant and bird and insect that I would have missed.
I'm not very good with people, said Drusha. If he'd been a little hill hawk, I could have probably told you which direction he flew off in, how fast, and where his roost was.
Did he tell you his name? Asked Betancourt.
Yes. I think he said it was Essek.
Warrior and Betancourt exchanged glances. Betancourt stepped forwards and put a data slate on the table in front of Drusha.
Is this him? She asked.
No. No, that's a much older man, much older.
She adjusted the display.
How about this?
Drusha pushed his spectacles down his nose and squinted at the Pict.
Yes, he said. Yes, that's him. Who is he? Is he a suspect? Is he a criminal?
His name is Essek Fargul, said Warrier.
So related to the man who died here? Asked Drusha.
Both images are Essek Fargul, said Warrier, taken 40 years apart. He is the man who died here, in the fifth floor bedroom, 30 years ago.
There was a long silence.
Well, that's,
said Drusha.
I mean, that's patently ridiculous. I mean, I spoke to him. I shook his hand.
Quite possibly, said Warrier. That doesn't change the fact that he's dead.
I shook his hand, said Drusha quietly.
Take a deep breath, said Betancourt softly. Sometimes these things are difficult to process.
No, not really, ma'am, said Drusha. Grokshit, however, is difficult to process. Your data is wrong, Master Warrier. He clearly isn't dead.
He died of age-related illness and poor circumstance, said Warrier. He was 97.
Then the body was misidentified.
Magos, Drusha, please try to accept this information, said Warrier. Even if Fargul was somehow still alive, to admit the man you saw was much younger.
Well, juvenat work, said Drusha. It reverses the aging process, doesn't it? That's what I've heard. I've never had it myself.
I have, said Medea Betancourt. I am 164 standard years old.
Drusha's eyes widened.
Inquisitor Eisenhorn is at least a century older, she continued. Magos, juvenat work arrests aging. It seldom reverses it. If Fargul was alive, he would not look 50 or 60 years younger than he did in later life.
So you're telling me, said Drusha, a more reasonable explanation is that I met a ghost?
The term is inexact, said Warrier.
And shook his damned hand?
Let's talk about what you discussed with him, said Warrier.
No, said Drusha firmly. No, that's not going to happen. Two things are going to happen first. I want some anxiety meds, strong ones,
and I want an explanation that entirely lacks grokshit. And that's not an either-or thing. I want both, now, or I'm going to pack my bag and leave.
Don't be awkward, Magos, said Vorier.
We need to tell him, said Bettencourt, at least the basics.
Drusha thought she was talking to Vorier, but he saw she was looking up into space almost blankly. There was a soft pop, as though Drusha had yawned and cleared his ears. He distinctly heard a voice say,
Proceed.
What was that? He asked.
I think it would be better coming from you, she said.
Again, she was not speaking to Drusha or Vorier.
I know you're tired, but I think...
Wait.
Bettencourt looked at Drusha.
Wait a moment, Magos, she said.
Drusha wiggled the tip of his finger in his ear. His head felt blocked and oddly pressurized.
Main room.
What was that? Asked Drusha.
We're going to the main room, said Bettencourt.
Eisenhorn was waiting for them. He was sitting in a high-backed chair, and he looked as if he were enduring some silent torment. Drusha felt that Eisenhorn was not so much sitting in the chair, as the chair was preventing him from falling into the center of the world. His breathing was labored. Audler Jaff was lighting candles to draw back the gloom in the great hall. It was still cold, and the chill seemed to radiate from the Inquisitor. Outside, a storm had begun to grumble.
"Have a seat, Magos," Eisenhorn said.
Drusha sat down, facing Eisenhorn. Vorier and Bettencourt withdrew to sit on a bench at the back of the hall. Jaff lit the last of the candles and joined them. There was no one else around.
"I have Psychana abilities, Magos," said Eisenhorn. "Do you know what that means?"
"I suppose so." I never met someone who...
You probably have. We don't tend to advertise our talents. Mine are considerable. You had an encounter today, when you left the site without permission.
I'm sorry about that, Drusha began. Eisenhorn raised a hand to hush him.
I have no interest in rebuking you, Magos. To be honest, I am exhausted. I don't have the time or patience to bring you into line. If you wish for a rebuke, say so, and I will leave it to Vorier and Nail.
By all means, do continue, said Drusha.
Your encounter today was with a Psychana echo, an unanticipated side effect of work I was doing in the cold store.
A Psychana echo, sir?
You referred to it as a ghost, said Eisenhorn. That is a surprisingly accurate term.
It was a ghost?
Yes.
Well, Drusha hesitated. That's very curious. I don't know what to think about that. I may cry a little bit.
Don't,
said Eisenhorn. Do my best, mumbled Drusha.
Magos, your assessment of the bodies was interesting to me. It confirmed things that I had thought of, ideas I had begun to form. It was remarkably incisive. It revealed secrets that I have not shared.
Thank you. Did it?
The Inquisition is interested in this case for precisely the reasons you suggested, said Eisenhorn. Marshal Max circulated the facial reconstructs on all networks. One came to my attention. A person I knew. That's what brought me here.
You knew one of the victims?
Personally. She worked for me. A field agent. Her name was Thea Inchabel, an interrogator, the daughter of a very old and dear friend who had joined me to continue her late father's work. She came to this system 9 years ago to follow leads relating to a larger case I have been pursuing. She came at my request. Such investigations, Magos, they take time, years. I had not heard from her for some while. Her reports had become intermittent. I was concerned. But sometimes Ordo agents in deep cover operation are forced to go dark, for their own safety. Interrogator Inchabel was a very experienced and able operator. I was confident that she... He paused. I should have sent someone to find her, he said. I should not have waited so long. I owed that to her father. To watch out for his daughter.
I'm sorry, sir. said Drusha.
Now she's dead, said Eisenhorn. Her bones lying, unclaimed and unidentified, in Marshal Max's morgue. Her reconstruction of Thea's face brought me to Gershom, to find out what she had found out.
Drusha tilted his head to the side, questioning.
It's very difficult to get answers from the dead, said Eisenhorn.
I can imagine, said Drusha.
But there are means, said Eisenhorn.
Thunder rumbled on the far side of a neighboring mountain, and the first drops of rain began to strike the hall's windows.
A process of divination, of psychometric assay. It is a testing and complex craft, and should be attempted only by those who are well trained, or those who are prepared to face the consequences.
I'm not sure I know what you're describing, sir, said Drusha.
In layman's terms, Magos, a seance.
Oh, said Drusha.
The term we use is auto-seance, said Eisenhorn. Thea left nothing except her bones. No clothing, no effects, no trace of where she had been for 9 years, where she had lived. So, when I first arrived, I conducted a psychic audience with the remains. It was unpleasant and unrewarding.
Drusha began, but didn't really know what to say.
Thea had been dead for too long, said Eisenhorn. Her psionic essence was too far detached from her mortal relics. Also, I have reason to believe the means and process of her death were so reductive, so annihilating, that nothing sensible remained. I reached out and touched something, but it was not coherent.
Eisenhorn shifted in his seat and took a sip from a glass of Amasek that had been placed by his side. His hand was shaking.
I extracted only one thing, he went on. A brief fragmentary expression of an old fortress. It was not a clear mental image, but research had shown that there were several old structures in the Carinine region, old fortresses from the settlement era. This place, Helter, resembled the vision. It was the only such structure that remained intact within the vicinity of the bodies that were found in situ. So, I transferred my party here to begin an investigation, a thorough search of the surrounding area.
And you brought the bodies too? Said Drusha.
Yes, replied Eisenhorn, so I could repeat the auto-seance process with each one. It was a grueling process. Some were utterly inert. From the rest, I obtained nothing but incoherent pain. So, I widened my search and conducted similar divinations at the sites where bodies were found, as well as other locations in the forest. Again, nothing. As you have demonstrated, convincingly, they were dump sites. No psychometric echo of the victims' lives or the moments of their deaths would have lingered there anyway. The rain was beating hard now. Lightning blinked in the high windows.
About today, said Drusha.
In the woods. Eisenhorn cleared his throat. After you made your report, he said, I felt an urge to try again. To restage the divination with poor Thea's body. It was a grim and thankless effort that has left me drained. But I believe it had an unexpected consequence. While I was here, in the cold store, trying to reach Thea Inchabel, the considerable psychanic backwash rippled out into the surrounding forest. It stirred up ghosts, Magos Drusha. Ghosts I was not aware of. Which is how you came to meet Essek Fargul in the woods today. A man 30 years dead. I was conducting my seance in his home, Magos. The place where he had lived, and the place where he died. It is hardly surprising that it might raise him up into the sunlight.
Not to you, perhaps, said Drusha. I have to say, sir, that I am half out of my mind just now. Fear, sir, at what you are telling me, at you. Fear and incredulity. I spoke to the man for 10 minutes. He was real. He was solid. I could see him and hear him and smell his hair oil and the sweat of a body that has walked briskly in the sun for a whole afternoon. I shook his hand.
"We have used the word ghost carelessly, Magos," said Eisenhorn. "A psionic manifestation can be very real, utterly convincing, especially to one who does not realize that it is what it is."
"Or that something like it could even exist," said Drusha. May I have an Amasek?"
Eisenhorn made a small nod. An Audler Jaff came over. She handed Drusha a fine old glass filled with Amasek.
"If it eases your mind at all," said Eisenhorn. "I doubt the Phantom of Essek Fargul knew he was a ghost either."
"With respect, it doesn't really," said Drusha.
He knocked back the drink in one. Jaff, waiting patiently nearby, stepped in and refilled the glass.
"What did you speak of, Magos?" asked Eisenhorn.
Drusha shrugged feebly.
"We talked as two men of similar interest might if they met by chance," he replied, "of nature, of the country and its various species. He had a leaning to natural history. He asked if I was a visitor, if I was staying nearby. He told me he was a local man with a timber business, and—"
"When he asked you that," Eisenhorn interrupted, "what did you say?"
"I told him yes," said Drusha, "that I was staying in the area. I didn't say where, so he asked me if I was a guest of his neighbor."
"His neighbor?"
"A friend, a local man of some influence who entertained famously."
"His name?"
"His name?"
Drusha echoed. He frowned.
"I can't recall. Straker? No, Draker. Something like that. Draven something. Draven Sirk? Stark?"
"Sark," said Eisenhorn. "Was that the name?"
"I think it was. I can't be sure, but Sark, Draven Sark, I feel that's what he said."
"So did Thea,"
said Eisenhorn, quietly. Vorier rose to his feet.
"My lord," he said, "you said you got nothing today."
"I didn't think I had, interrogator," said Eisenhorn. "Just sounds. Noises. The wailing psionic roar of the warp. But one sound repeated, and now the Magos says the name, I know that's what it was. A name. Sark. Thea Inchabel was screaming it."
"I will begin a search for the name," said Jaff.
She looked at Drusha.
"Do you know the spelling?"
"Of course I don't," said Drusha.
Eisenhorn slowly rose to his feet, almost clawing at the edge of the table for support.
"Throne," he murmured. "All along Inchabel was trying to tell me something. It was the last remaining fragment of her, the only thing she had strength of will to hold on to. One word. One name. And I didn't realize."
Medea Betancourt had come to his side to steady him.
"You should rest, Gregor," she said.
"I should work."
"Leave it to us for now," she said,
shaking her head.
"Let us do the research. Rest and regain your strength. You're no good to us otherwise."
"I know where he lived," said Drusha.
Everyone looked at him.
"This Draven Sark," said Drusha. "The ghost told me. He said Sark was a neighbor. He lived in another old fortress close by. Down towards the pass, he said, and older than this place. Pre-Uderin, he called it. Its name is Kestri."
Chapter 9. That which is not there.
"Come with me," said Vorier.
Audler Jaff had gone off to begin her research. Drusha wasn't sure what that meant, and he didn't like to imagine. Medea Betancourt had begun the slow process of leading Eisenhorn up the stairs to his chamber. Full night had closed in, and with it a thunderstorm of monstrous proportions. Lightning strobed at the fortress windows. The shutters rattled, and the stone hallways resounded with the drumming of rain outside, and the frantic dripping within, as water drained through the ragged roof and dribbled into pots and buckets.
Vorier led Drusha to a small parlour behind the kitchen, where the others were waiting. A fire had been lit, and it was verging on cosy. Max looked up as they entered. Nail was by the hearth, chatting to the three deputies. The storm had driven Cronil and Edda indoors. Their boots were off, and they were trying to dry their socks against the fire.
"Has something happened?"
asked Garifar, lowering a mug of caffeine.
"We may have a lead," said Vorier. "Can I borrow you, Marshal?"
"Of course," said Max, rising to her feet.
"We need some local data," said Vorier. "Do you have maps? I'll need your link to the Magistratum database."
"No problem," said Max. "That is, if the uplink is still working. The storm's playing blessed hell with Vox connections. Look, if it's local information you need, ask my deputies. I'm not from the area, but they were all born in Ankara."
"Keshtri," said Vorier. He looked at the deputies. "Mean anything to any of you?"
"Not me," said Edda.
Cronil shook his head.
"The bad place?"
asked Garifar.
"What?"
asked Vorier.
"Like in the bedtime story."
Garifar's voice trailed off. He blushed.
"Sorry, I wasn't trying to be funny."
"Go on, Hadid," said Max.
"I don't know, ma'am,"
said Garifar.
"It was just a story, a fairy story. The bad place up in the hills, Keshtri, where the monsters lived. We had to go to bed when we were told and behave and stuff, or the monsters would creep down in the night and steal us away."
"Where is it?" asked Drusha.
"Begging your pardon, sir," said Garifar. "It's not anywhere. It was just a made-up thing."
"It's a fortress, apparently," Vorier said to Max. "Near here, towards the pass. That's right, isn't it, Magos?"
"That's what the ghost told me," said Drusha. He knew he could have phrased it better, but he quite enjoyed the look his comment got from everyone.
"There's no other fortresses near here, sir," said Cronil.
"Not between here and the pass. The closest is Angmire, but that's 40 kilometres north."
"No, Korlok is closer," said Edda. "That's near town, over west."
"Oh, yeah, Korlok," said Cronil. "But that's just a ruin."
"Well, they're all ruins," said Edda, "apart from Helter. And this place isn't much better than a ruin."
"Yeah, but Korlok and Angmire aren't ruined, said Cronil. "I don't mean fallen stones and traces. The woods are full of that kind of rubble. I thought we were talking places that are still standing."
"This place would be intact," Drusha said to Vorier. "At least in recent memory. There was somebody living in it maybe 50 or 60 years ago." The deputies shook their heads.
"Nowhere like that, sir," said Edda.
"You sure you mean Keshtri?" asked Garifar.
"What about the name Draven Sark?" asked Drusha. The deputies looked blank. "Let's go check it," said Max. "All the research material is in the library. Garifar, you come along."
"Do you need me?"
Nail asked Vorier.
"Get your things together, Harlan," said Vorier. "Take Cronil and Edda and do a sweep. Make sure we're locked down."
Drusha and Max followed Vorier up the stairs to the library. Garifar hurried along behind them, buttoning his service jacket. Drusha hadn't seen the library before. It smelled of damp. Rain battered at the shutters and rustled the plastic sheeting. The room was lit by glow globes and candles. The wind was fluttering the candle flames and stirring loose papers stacked with the piles of old books. Audler Jaff was sitting on the chaise, working methodically through a pile of tomes.
"Anything?"
asked Vorier. "The name Kestra appears in 3 folk tales," she replied. "It's not a location. It's just a myth. An imaginary place."
"Why would he have told me a lie?" asked Drusha.
"Who?" asked Max. Drusha shook his head.
"The word is not Ankaran dialect," said Jaff. "All the fortresses have names of Karanine origin, even those of the pre-Eudarian era. Kestri is a derivative of the Fent language of Outer Udar, possibly a pre-Gothic proto-root. It means speaking place or meeting place, a moot or court, perhaps, but there is a sinister aspect to it. Literally, forbidden speaking place or place of unholy speech. I repeat, it's not a physical location. It's not on the maps. It's not in the histories."
"It could be an old name for somewhere else," said Drusha.
"Not that I've found," said Jaff. She looked somewhat annoyed.
"Keep looking through the old man's books," said Vorier.
"There are only a few I haven't reviewed," Jaff replied.
"Then go back over the rest," Borier snapped.
"I retain everything I read, interrogator," Jaff protested.
"Just do it," said Borier. "I'm not doubting your ability, Savon. We now have key words to look for. Names, Kestre and Dravensark. We have an approximate location. You may make a connection that you didn't make before."
She sniffed. "Of course," she said, and turned back to the books.
"We'll look over the area maps again," said Vorier.
Garifar and Max were already rolling out the magistratum charts on a side table. They had territorial surveys dating back 9 decades.
"She doesn't like you much,"
Drusha whispered to Vorier.
"Odla is very precise," replied Vorier quietly. "In human levels of retention, processing, and data comparison, she is offended when I question her efforts."
They began to study the maps. Vorier uncased a portable cogitator and plugged its cables into a voxcaster signal amplifier that stood on the floor nearby. He began to type.
"Damn," he muttered. "The link keeps going down."
"We could drive back to Ankara town," said Max. "Use the hardwired system in the magistratum building."
Vorier looked doubtful.
"I'll keep trying for now," he said. "This storm's got to ease back at some point."
"There's nothing on the maps," said Garifar.
Drusha was peering over the deputy's shoulder. He had quickly identified the symbols for ruin, standing, and ruin, sight. Most of the latter represented sites that he doubted would be apparent to anything except ground-penetrating auspecs, geophysical detectors, or the high-gain scanning of fleet survey vessels. You could visit them in person, walk around, and see nothing that suggested a structure had ever been there. He found Helter Fortress marked, and saw there were several ruins standing and ruins sight to the south and west within 100 kilometres, but nothing to the north and east, where the spur of the range ran.
"That must be the pass," he said, tapping the map with his fingertip to indicate a significant pass through the Carinine Range that lay north of Helter Fortress.
"The Carad Pass," agreed Garifar.
Down towards the pass. That's what the ghost had said.
"So he must have meant this area here,"
Drusha mused. He circled the tract of mountain country between their current location and the dramatic formation of the pass at Carad.
"Who?" asked Max.
"My source," said Drusha carefully.
"Look," said Max, "if it's not a place, like Hadid says, not an actual place..."
"It's just a story," said Garifar. "Honestly."
"What? We're wasting our time?" asked Drusha.
Max shook her head.
"No," she said. "Like you said just now, it could be an old name for something else, or a fanciful name someone gave to somewhere else. I mean, not official. Look, imagine Fargul had moved into this place and decided to call it Fargul's Palace instead of Helter Fortress. That wouldn't necessarily be recorded on a map or the title register. Likewise, he could have called it Elysium or Vartuk. You know, ironically."
"Var what?" asked Drusha.
"Vartuk," said Max. "It's a local dialect word for heaven or paradise. You Darik, right, Garifar?"
"I think that's right," said the deputy.
"You mean he calls it that because it's a nice place to retire to?" Drusha asked.
Max looked at him patiently. It was a look he knew well.
"You're getting hung up on my example, Valentin," she said. "I'm making it up as an illustration. This Draven Sark, you said he was a rich man. Influential. He had a grand country seat. He could have cheerfully trashed any name it used to have and given it a new one. Something his friends and acquaintances would know it as, but it wouldn't be official."
"So it could mean anywhere," said Garifar. "Any old site in the province."
"Potentially," said Max.
Drusha sighed.
"I don't think so. Near to Helter, but towards the pass. I know that's not specific enough, but it's still specific." "Well, you've seen for yourself," said Max. "There's nothing in that area at all. It's wilderness."
"We could try older maps," said Garifar. "What about the settlement territory surveys? They might be on file at the Administratum Annex, or even in the museum."
"No," said Drusha. "We're not looking for some site so ancient it had vanished before we started making modern maps. It was an occupied dwelling less than a century ago. It can't have completely vanished in that time."
"Unless, you know, it's a shade hall," said Garifar.
Max and Drusha looked at him. The deputy gestured, embarrassed to brush his remark aside.
"Ignored me," he said. "It was supposed to be a joke."
I'll ignore you, Garifar, said Max, once you explain what a Shade Hall is.
Well, that's what they said about Kestry in the old stories, he replied reluctantly. In the fairy stories, that it was only there some of the time. It appeared at night, so the monsters that lived inside could roam. Then it faded away at dawn, back into the realm of shades.
Max glared at him.
I shouldn't joke, said Garifar. I know this is serious, Mum. I'm sorry.
The Shade Hall, or Fairy Mound, is an ancient trope, said Audler Jaff, looking up from her work. A liminal location, a threshold place, that exists between the material world and the other world. It's a concept that recurs in works of folklore right back to old Terra.
Don't try and make excuses for him, ma'am, Max said to her. We're not looking for a fairy mound. She turned her attention back to the deputy.
Garifar, why don't you go see if Master Nail needs help with a sweep?
Yes, Mum, said Garifar sheepishly, and hurried from the room.
Anything? Max asked Vorier.
He was still at work on the cogitator.
I might have found a reference to the name Sark, said Vorier, but the link is damn slow. I keep having to resend and start over.
Drusha wandered over to the bookshelves. He ran his finger along the old decaying spines. There were a lot of books of natural history. Essek Fargul had liked his ornithology. Drusha saw old treatises on migration and nesting patterns, guides to birdsong, feeding grounds. He saw a slim volume at the end of the shelf called Folk Verse of the Carinine Passes and took it down. Damp had got to it. It was very much the worse for wear.
There's nothing in that, sir, said Jaff, not even looking up.
Drusha frowned at her dubiously.
She knows, Magos, said Vorier. Trust me on that.
Drusha opened the old book anyway. The pages rotted away, flaked out in a puff of damp fibres, unintelligible.
Literally nothing in this case, he said.
Max sniggered. Drusha looked at the book for a moment longer, the empty, discoloured cover, the mulch of paper fibres clinging to the binding. Something that had been, but was no longer. Valentin Drusha's worst enemy was his own imagination. It was a fact he had recognized and accepted many times in the past.
What if, he began,
Valentin?
Max, what if the deputy was right, he said.
Meaning what?
Asked Max, coming over. That this Kestry place only partly shares our physical reality. That it's not there all the time.
Just like the scary bedtime stories say.
Max put her hands on her hips and gave him a withering look.
I know, he smiled. The version of me that got here this morning would have looked at me exactly the same way, but, Germaine, the things I've seen today, the impossibilities. I have always been able to codify the living world according to its rules and its laws and its constants. I look for that. My work is about that. It's reassuring. It's comforting when things make sense. But now I'm not sure of anything. I think anything is possible. The rules of sense be damned.
Chapter 10 Restless. The storm continued into the small hours. After midnight, the thunder diminished into a background grumble, but the downpour increased, beating at the walls and roof like timpani. It felt as though the whole mountainside would wash away in a deluge of mud and take Helter Fortress with it.
I'm going to do a sweep, said Max. In truth, she needed to clear her head. She was beginning to fall asleep over the charts. A circuit would clear her drowsiness.
Vorier and Jaff barely looked up from their work to acknowledge her comment. Drusha had already retired. To his bed, Max presumed. She buckled on her uniform jacket, picked up her riot gun and a Plastec slicker, and left the library. The fortress was silent, except for the drumming rain and the constant spattering chime of the roof leaks spilling down into pans and buckets. Everything smelled damp. Only a few lamps and candles had been left along the galleries and staircases, so Max fished out her stablight. On the second floor, she saw Medea Betancourt on a bench outside the chamber reserved for Eisenhorn. Betancourt was working through a data slate. She looked tired.
"Anything, Marshal?"
she asked, as Max approached. Max shook her head.
"He's sleeping at last,"
said Betancourt, tilting her head towards the chamber door.
"He needs it."
"You need it too, ma'am," said Max.
"In a while, perhaps,"
replied Betancourt,
I'll stay here for now, in case he needs me. The dreams wake him.
Max nodded. Bettencourt returned to her data slate, and Max made her way back to the stairs. She went down to the main entrance, pulling on her slicker. Nail had set up lighting rigs in the yard on their arrival, and she could see their white glow backlighting the small windows above the door. She dragged the door open. The yard was bathed in harsh white light from the rigs. Where the heavy rain caught in their stark glare, it made dark stripes like vertical interference bands on a picked feed. Max could hear the chatter of the portable generator running the rigs, a murmur behind the constant snake hiss of the downpour. She saw Nail across the yard by the gate. Edda was with him, and they had the main gate dragged open a yard or two, so they could look out into the night. Max hurried across to them, the rain pattering off her plastic shroud. The air was cold and fresh. She already had water running down the back of her neck.
"Anything?" she asked.
Nail glanced at her, water dripping off his solid chin.
"Something tripped the outer senses about half an hour ago," he said. "Probably just an animal, but Garofar and Cronil are checking."
"Should I get everyone up?" she asked. He shook his head.
"Probably just an animal," he repeated.
"Keep me advised," she said. "I'll sweep the house."
Max returned to the main building. She heaved the heavy door shut and shook off her slicker. She checked the kitchen, then the small back parlor. The fire there was still burning, making it the most comfortable room in the place. Drusha was asleep in an armchair. He hadn't gone to bed after all. He'd brought books down from the library, and one had fallen open across his chest as sleep claimed him. A book on migration habits in the Carinines. Max saw delicate line drawings of wildfowl. She closed the book and set it aside, drew Drusha's old coat across him as a blanket, and, as an afterthought, bent down and kissed him on the forehead. He stirred slightly, mumbled, and went back to sleep. Max had just entered the main hall when she heard the voice. It sounded like a cry. Not a cry of pain, but an urgent call, like someone far away shouting an order. She halted, listening. The hall was empty, and the candles had burned out. She heard the odd call again, in the distance, muffled by the rain. This time, when it came, her vox set squawked simultaneously, as if echoing the cry. Max adjusted the collar-mounted set. It emitted a quick squeal, then a harsh flood of static.
"Mr. Nail," she said, tipping her head to talk into the mic. "Mr. Nail, this is Marshal Max. Do you copy?"
Static fizzled.
"Nail, come back. This is Max."
There was a burble of audio noise, and then she heard Nail's voice.
"Reading you, Max."
"What was that?" asked Max.
"That noise?"
"Affirmative."
"Not sure,"
Nail's voice crackled back.
"Garofar and Cronil just got back to the gate. Cronil thinks it was an animal cry."
"Your vox go weird?" asked Max.
"Yeah, just for a second," Nail replied. "I think it's atmospherics. We've just got rain here now, but I can see some fierce electrical displays further down the valley."
Max wasn't convinced, but she knew how the storm had played hell with Vorier's uplink before midnight.
"Stay in contact," she said. "I'm going down to the cold store, then I'll walk to the west wall."
"Channel open,"
Nail responded. Max opened the cellar door and followed the stone steps down into the undercroft. There was no light except for her powerful stab beam. Then her eyes began to detect a faint blue glow. The door to the cold store was ajar. The glow of the stasis fields was shining out into the hall.
"Nail," she said into her mic, "the door to the cold store is open. Has anyone been down here?"
Static burbled back.
"Nail, respond."
Just more oddly modulated interference. Max waited for a moment. She wanted to move in with backup, but she didn't want to leave the door open, and she'd have to if she was going to go and fetch Nail and the deputies. She locked her stab light onto the under rail of her riot gun and moved forwards, aiming the light beam with her weapon. The door hadn't been forced. The bolts were on the outside, and they had been drawn back. Slowly, she eased the door open a little wider with the muzzle of her gun and peered in. The whitewashed chamber was lit by the blue ghost light of the field units. The gurneys sat in rows, green plastic sheets over the remains. Over 17 of the gurneys. One, in the middle of the rows, was empty. The plastic sheet was crumpled on the stone floor beside its wheels. One of the bodies was gone. Max cursed under her breath. She edged forwards and slowly settled down into a crouch so she could peer under the rows of gurneys and play her stab light around. Nothing. No heap of bones on the floor. And how did a bundle of bones fall off a gurney anyway? Max rose again slowly, her weapon raised and ready. She realized she was breathing hard, and she forced herself to slow the rate. She backed gently to the doors and stepped out into the corridor.
"Neil,"
she whispered into the mic on her collar. Still nothing. She braced her weapon with one hand and pushed the cold store door shut, resetting the bolts. Something beside her screamed. Max jumped in shock and wheeled around, her weapon leveled. Her heart was racing. There was nothing there. She circled, hunting the length of the corridor both ways with her powerful beam. Nothing. The scream came again.
"Thrown!"
she spat. It was her vox. Her damn vox. It was squalling and yelping, uttering shrill bursts of audio wash.
"Neil!"
she snapped, gripping the collar unit with one hand.
"Neil, respond!"
She headed back towards the stairs to the main hall.
"Neil, someone's been into the cold store. There's a set of remains missing." "Neil!"
Static fluttered. She half heard her name, scrambled by the interference.
"Neil, do you copy?"
"Marshall, say again."
"Neil, the cold store's been opened. A body's gone."
"Copy that."
Neil's reply was masked with noise.
"Meet me at the entrance,"
she barked. Silence.
"Neil?"
She reached the main hall and closed the cellar door. For a moment, she thought she saw someone standing at the far end of the hall, a figure in the shadows. But as soon as she turned her stab light that way, it was gone. Just her imagination. She got herself spooked. Her mind was playing tricks. She headed for the front entrance, but changed her mind and switched down the side passage to the parlor first. Drusha was still sound asleep in front of the hearth.
"Valentin?"
She shook him.
"Valentin!"
He woke up, bleary.
"What? Is it... what?"
"Something's going on," she said. "Get up."
"What?"
he asked, blinking.
"What sort of something?"
"I don't know. Something."
He got to his feet, his limbs stiff.
"You look scared," he said.
"Just get your coat on,"
she replied.
"Germaine, why are you scared?"
Drusha asked.
"Shut up and get your coat on, Magus,"
she said.
"We're going outside."
He struggled into his coat. She could see that she'd alarmed him. He wasn't properly awake, and everything was an effort.
"One of the bodies has gone," she said.
He looked at her.
"Gone? In what way?"
"In a not-there-anymore way, Drusha. I just checked the cold store. A body has gone."
"Taken?" he asked.
"Well, of course. How else would a body disappear? Someone's in the house."
"You've seen?"
"I haven't seen anything. But someone must have come in. Hurry up!"
He followed her to the door, and they went out together into the kitchen passageway. There was someone at the far end, by the hall door.
"Mr. Neil!"
Max called out. She raised the stab beam. She'd found the missing body. It was standing up, a twisted skeletal figure, caked in dirt and black organic tatters. It began to limp towards them. Certain things had trailed Valentin Drusha around his whole life. Poverty was one. Frustration was another. A lack of confidence. A wounded sense of being overlooked. All of those things had visited him on an intermittent basis. But fear had been, pretty much, a constant companion. Drusha's fear took many forms. Sometimes it was abstract, like his fear of failure, and its ugly, contrary twin, his fear of success. He was afraid of authority, and afraid of being forgotten. Mostly, his fear manifested as a simple fear of pain. He was a nervous, timid man who lived in dread of a midnight knock at the door from a predatory road mob, or of getting in a fight when he was minding his own business, or of being dragged away and beaten by law enforcement if his papers weren't up to date. He was afraid of heights and of drowning. He was afraid of being hurt. A lingering early memory was the fear of the aggressive canine his father had kept, a creature that never seemed to tolerate Drusha.
During his long years of training and education, he had lived in perpetual anxiety about being bitten or stung or clawed by the lab animals and wild specimens he was examining. Even as a Magos, that fear had persisted, making him tentative in his work and his studies. He knew a lot about animal behavior, and, for the most part, he knew how to avoid the risks and handle potentially dangerous life forms. But the most basic rule of all was that even a Magos biologist never knew everything, and that an animal, especially one trapped or surprised, could do the unexpected. The damn sea raptor had remained in its cage for months because he'd been too afraid to get near to it. Twice in his life he had faced things that were truly fearful. The unholy Xenos specimen that he and Max had cornered in a mill in Outer Udar years before, and the psychotic killing thing he had hunted in Tycho City. Those fears lived with him and woke him at night, even though the dangers had long passed. They were hard-edged fears, and they tasted bitter, like dirty iron pressing on his tongue. They made his pulse skip and his skin go clammy. They made him dull and stupid, as if fear were a weight that pressed common sense and logical response out of his head. Both of those truly fearful experiences had happened when he was in the company of Jermaine Max. She was like a damned jinx that made bad things happen to him, not insane adventures. That was a euphemistic, jolly term that suggested thrills and excitement. Just bad things. Things that had put him in the path of genuine, violent extermination. Things he didn't wish to repeat or even remember. The closest he'd ever come to death. But there, in the kitchen passageway of Helter Fortress, with Max's stab light, yes, Max there yet again, the common denominator of his misfortune, with her stab light illuminating the ghastly and impossible as it hobbled towards them, he oddly felt no fear at all. The figure was simply unbelievable. Old human bones, mottled and stained by loam and mildew and decay, roughly assembled in anatomical order, scabbed and crusted with mould and dried black blood and residual masses of dead sinew and tissue. The empty eye sockets were dark pits of shadow. For a moment, time seemed to dawdle, as if waiting for Drusha's mind to catch up. He became aware of how not frightened he was. Perhaps he was simply denying what was in front of him, refusing to accept it. Perhaps it was just so extraordinary it had taken him beyond the limits of any fear he could register. Perhaps the day had already been too strange. He had been forced to accept things that his scientific background did not allow for. The workings of the psychanic mind, the notion of speaking to the dead, the post-mortal apparition of an old man. He had, for Throne's sake, shaken hands with a ghost. Perhaps the strange day spent in the company of Eisenhorn and his curious band of assistants had acted as a crash course, a steep learning curve into the truths of the unknown. Perhaps the day had been like a baptism, annealing his soul and his fear so that it was ready for this moment. Or perhaps it was just too fascinating. Drusha's curiosity, the appetite for wonder and discovery that had steered him into his profession, had eclipsed all fears. Even the Xenos thing he had faced in the windmill all those years ago, that had been definable. He'd been able to know it, to describe it in accurate terms. He'd been afraid of it simply because it had been going to kill him. But this was beyond his considerable framework of knowledge. He wanted to know what it was. He wanted to understand how it could be, how it could exist. It was just organic waste, the skeletal relic of a dead human being. It had no life. It was a broken frame that had once supported life, but that was all. Even on a basic level of organic engineering, the greater part of the mechanism was missing. There were no muscles or tendons left to support or move the bones, no blood supply to feed those muscles, no nerves to stimulate motion and control balance, no heart to pump the blood, no organs to fuel the process, no brain in that cranium to make walking a desire, no eyes to see them with. But it saw them. And it walked. A precarious, slow walk, like a frail old man. It saw Valentin Drusha and Jermaine Max, and it walked towards them. "That," Drusha said, almost brightly.
That is highly unlikely.
Max mumbled something that wasn't properly a word. The approaching figure appeared to shudder slightly. Drusha realized that the powerful stab beam transfixing it was quivering. Max's hands were trembling wildly. He could hear her sobbing and hyperventilating. He knew, under any other circumstances, he would be doing the same thing. His mind would have closed down in the choking paralysis of fear.
"Germaine," he said gently.
"Germaine." He put his arm around her shoulder. She was shaking so badly it felt like she was vibrating. She was making an odd mewling sound. She couldn't not look at it. Drusha couldn't look away either, but he reached out with his free hand and took the riot gun from her, keeping the stab light aimed at the walking thing. He squeezed his arm tight around her quaking shoulders.
"Germaine, come on," he said. "Come with me. Take a step backwards. That's it. And another."
He edged them towards the parlor door. She shook against him. Drusha could smell the thing advancing towards them. He could smell rot, not the gross, gagging stink of putrescence, but the faded, dry fragrance of end-stage decomposition.
"Germaine, another step."
They had reached the parlor door. He pushed Max into the room, and she almost fell through the doorway. Drusha turned back to face the walking thing.
"What are you?" he asked. "Can you speak?"
"You shouldn't be able to, but then you shouldn't be able to walk either."
"Can you tell me what you are? Can you tell me how you are possible?"
The figure could not. It simply continued its inexorable trudge towards Drusha. Its right arm began to rise, as if it were reaching out to touch him.
"I'd like an answer," said Drusha. "If you won't answer, or you can't, I'd like you to go."
By the light of the torch fastened under the barrel of Max's heavy weapon, Drusha saw that some kind of energy discharge was crackling over the walking bones, like a faint bioluminescence. It was an electric green, which reminded him of deep-sea leechfish, or the cave worms, Nematodus cryptus, that he had catalogued in southern Gersha. The glow came and went, never totally present. For a moment it shimmered around arm bones, and he saw the brief, ghostly traceries of veins and capillaries. He saw phantom tendons and intercostals come and go across stained ribs. He saw spectral organs pulse in the abdominal void. Some kind of energetic pattern, a light echo of the lost soft organics. Green pinpricks lit in the empty orbits of the skull sockets, the ghosts of eyes.
"If you don't answer, then we're done," said Drusha. "This will be good night. I won't allow you to come any closer. I have a gun. It will shatter what little is left of you."
The skeletal thing took another wavering step closer.
"I warned you," said Drusha.
Very calmly, he thumbed off the weapon's safety, braced it in a low grip because he knew it would kick, and fired. In the tight confines of the passageway, the boom was deafening. The blast hit the figure in the sternum. The explosive force dissipated like steam. Drusha heard flecks of shot patter onto the stone floor, all force spent. The figure kept coming, as though nothing had happened.
"Thrown," said Drusha.
He charged the pump grip and fired again, then repeated quickly. Each shot blew out like vapor as it reached the advancing thing. Only now did fear begin to register in Valentin Drusha. He felt it creep into his joints like frost, numbing him. He got the first taste of bitter metal on his tongue. He fired one more shot, then ran into the parlor and slammed the door. Chapter 11. At the threshold. He locked the door behind him. As an afterthought, he dragged one of the old armchairs over and shoved it against the door. Max was staring at him. Her eyes were red, and she wiped at her dripping nose with her sleeve.
We, he began. "Did you see it?" she whispered. "You saw it too?"
He nodded.
"I shot it," he said. "Several times." "Did you?"
she asked, her voice very small.
"Did you kill it?"
No, he said.
"Not really at all. I don't think it can die, because it's not alive. Something odd happened with your gun. Is it loaded? I mean, did you put some kind of blanks in it?" "What are you even saying?" she gasped at him, incredulous. "Blanks, you know, poof," he said. "The shots didn't do any damage. Like they were just dummy rounds."
Max swallowed hard. She took a step forwards and snatched the gun from his hands.
"Breacher rounds," she said, popping the slide open to show him the red Munitorum stencil on the yellow sleeve of the ready shell. "It will blow a hole in a bloody door. Knock a man down, even in armor."
Do they go off?" he asked.
"I mean, do they spoil if you don't use them?"
"You're an idiot," she snapped, staring at him with wide eyes.
"What are you going on about?"
"It doesn't matter," he said, trying to sound calm, even though a degree of panic was now rising in him, as if he was wading slowly and steadily deeper into an ice bath.
"I shut the door. I locked it."
"Oh, good," she said sarcastically. She sat down in the other armchair, then immediately got up again.
"You saw it, right?" she asked him. "You saw that?"
"I did," he said.
"I've never," she murmured, pacing. "I swear by the throne, I've never been so scared. That was impossible. I mean, completely and utterly bloody impossible."
"In the most literal and scientific way," he agreed.
"Is it still outside?"
she asked. Drusha looked at the locked door and the chair wedged up against it.
"Probably," he said. "I'd prefer not to check."
Max looked nervously around the small room. There were no other doors and no windows.
"We can't get out," she said.
"If it's outside the door..."
"It can't get in," he replied.
"It will go away." She looked at him.
"You didn't freeze up," she said. "Why didn't you freeze up? You always freeze up."
Drusha shrugged.
"I don't know. Scientific curiosity," he said.
"Crack shit," she said.
"You kept it together somehow." "I've rapidly developed a high threshold for strange," he said.
After a moment he added,
"I think it's beginning to hit me now, though."
There was a soft noise. They both looked at the door sharply. It was a scratching sound, like a hound pawing to be let in. The coarse, dry scrape of unfleshed distal phalanges clawing at the old wood of the door. Max cursed. They both backed away from the door.
"It can't get in," he said. "I locked it. It can't get in."
He felt that if he repeated it enough, it would become true. Something started to happen to the door. It shivered slightly. Then a dark patch began to appear at shoulder height, as though a blowtorch was being applied to the other side. The patch grew and spread. The wood began to flake and fall away. It looked for all the worlds of man as if the wood were simply and rapidly decomposing. Max swore again. The decay spread, eating the wood away. Flecks of pulp billowed out from the collapsing surface, as though invisible swarms of boring insects were desiccating the wood and devouring it. Max and Drusha could smell burned sawdust and mildew. A portion of the upper panel fell away. The decay spread was accelerating. A powerful corrosive sprayed on the door could not have gnawed the fabric away so fast. A bone hand reached in through the gap, flaking the wood, clasping and unclasping at the open air.
"Oh, holy throne!" Max murmured.
The door began to collapse in its frame. Parts of it became smoke that boiled with electric green sparks, motes of dust that tumbled as they burned out. Larger sections fell out whole, bursting into dust as they bounced off the armchair and hit the ground. The figure began to push its way in. They saw the green light of its stare burning from its hollow sockets. They heard the squat legs of the old, heavy chair scrape on the flagstones as it was slowly shoved out of the doorway. Max fumbled for her vox.
"Nail! Nail!" she yelled. "For throne's sake, help us! The parlor behind the kitchen! It's going to kill us!"
The vox channel warbled back, wordlessly. Drusha looked around frantically. No other doors, no windows. He ran over to the hearth. The firebox was mounted in the stone chimney-place, a later addition to replace the original open fire. Black iron pipework vented the flue up into the chimney itself. The chimney was blocked around the main flue with a sooty metal plate. He tried to move the firebox, but withdrew his hands instantly with a yelp. Though the fire was dying, the metal was still hot. He kicked instead, savagely and repeatedly, trying to dislodge the firebox from the fireplace. It gradually began to shift. The chimney plate came loose at one side, spilling out clouds of choking soot, and the flue slit. Max glanced at him.
"What are you doing?" she yelled.
"The chimney!"
Drusha replied as he kept kicking furiously. He said it as if that were explanation enough. She understood his meaning.
"We won't fit up the chimney," she yelled. "Yes, we will. We can't climb. Yes, we can. Help me. It won't work, Valentin," she shouted.
He paused, breathing hard from the exertion.
"The alternative is staying in this room," he said.
He started kicking again. The firebox shifted with a shriek of metal on stone, and sooty clouds spilled out of it. Max looked back at the door. The thing was nearly through. Only the chair stood in its way, blocking it.
"Nail," she yelled. "Assist, now, for the love of terror!"
She hoisted the riot gun and began to shoot, methodically pumping shot after shot at the thing. One round blew out part of the door frame. Another punched through the headrest of the armchair, filling the air with clouds of white kapok. Each shot that hit the thing itself fizzled into nothing. It strained on relentlessly past the obstacle. Bone hands clawed at the chair, and decay began to spread out from its touch. The upholstery started to wither and perish, exposing yellowed stuffing, springs and wooden frame. Then those too began to disintegrate. The chair gradually decomposed from the seat back down, dissolving into dust. One arm slumped aside as the back frame powdered. Hungry green sparks writhed on the remaining upholstery. Max turned to Drusha and began to kick with him. The firebox dislodged entirely and fell heavily onto its front. They pulled at the broken vent and the chimney plate, ignoring the burns they got from the metal. Accumulated black filth poured out of the flue, decades of dust and soot. They were both coughing and choking. The plate fell out with a clang. Drusha looked over his shoulder. The chair was all but gone. The thing was in the room.
"Get up there," he yelled at her. "You first. Just get up the chimney, Germaine. I'll boost you."
She tossed the riot gun and wriggled down into the hot cavity of the chimney place, groping for handholds on the stone. Drusha bent down and made a stirrup from his hands, cradling her right foot to hoist her.
"Climb," he yelled. "Climb, Germaine."
He didn't dare look behind him. He didn't want to see when it happened. Max's head and upper body were inside the flue. He could hear her scrabbling for grip.
"It's too small," he heard her yelling, muffled. "It's too tight. I can't."
Old, heat-cracked stone inside the chimney gave way. Max lost her grip and came crashing back out, chunks of stone falling with her. She almost landed on Drusha. They both went over in the hearth.
"Megas, stay down."
Drusha heard the commanding voice. He saw Nail in the doorway behind the walking thing. Garifar and the other deputies were crowding in behind Nail, staring in utter dismay at the sight in front of them. But Nail's face was grim, as if he'd seen the impossible far too many times before. He raised his las rifle. Drusha grabbed Max and pulled her as flat as he could, covering her head and shoulders with his own arms and body. Nail fired a sustained burst. Shrieking bolts of light ripped into the parlor, striking the figure from behind, doing nothing but making it jerk a little. Stray bolts tore past it, blowing holes in the far wall over Drusha and Max. Several shots crippled the old wooden dresser pushed against the wall. It shook, sagged, and toppled over on its front. The figure swayed, then slowly turned to face Nail and the deputies behind him.
"Oh, holy terror," Garifar gasped.
The figure took its first lurching step towards Nail. It raised its right hand to stroke his face. Nail fired again. The las bolts pummeled at its ribcage, but their heat and light vaporized on contact, becoming a lambent crackle that radiated out across the skeletal form and vanished. Nail cursed. He stood his ground in the doorway and let go of the las rifle so that it dropped hard onto its sling, swinging at his waist. He drew a heavy auto-pistol from a chest holster, ejected the clip, racked the weapon open, and took a single round from his breast pocket. He fitted it into the open receiver, slammed the slide shut, and took aim with both hands. The thing was just an arm's length from him. Nail fired. The shot struck the figure in the forehead. The skull burst like a smashed vase. Bone shards sprayed in all directions. Headless, the figure wavered for a moment. Electric green energy patterns coursed and flickered around its frame. Then they winked out. The dead bones abruptly disarticulated and collapsed like rubbish tipped out of a bucket. They fell in a heap on the parlor floor where the figure had been standing. Thin smoke curled up from the mound of bones. Nail lowered the pistol.
"Get Eisenhorn," he said.
Chapter 12.
The House of Sark. Early morning light peered in through the slit windows of the washroom on the second floor of the fortress. It was a grey day outside, but the storm had cleared, and the rain had eased back to drizzle. Drusha was clean but shivering. There had been no hot water to fill the tin tub, and it had taken a long time to scrub the fireplace soot out of his skin. He had a clean shirt, but his jacket and trousers were the only ones he'd brought along, and he had been forced to put them back on despite the dirt that had rubbed into the fabric. Max came in. She'd washed earlier, and her uniform looked clean, but her face was drawn and pale.
"I brought you these," she said, and held out a box of dressings for the burns on his hands.
"Are you all right?" he asked. She looked away, then took a breath and busied herself applying salve to his palms and fingers. He held his hands out obediently. He wanted to say something, something about what had happened, and not just the horror that had overtaken them in the parlour, about everything, about their chance meeting 27 years before, about their insane adventures, which, to him, included 3 oddly sweet years in Tycho City that had finally ended in a lot of shouting and slamming of doors. As usual, and as then, his interpersonal skills failed him.
"The arch-enemy of mankind," she said, eventually.
"The what?"
"That's what it was," she said. "What they preach about, what they tell us to watch for. I never really thought it was real. But that was real."
"I never thought about it much myself," he replied. "I know the edicts, the directives, but I've always found life quite challenging enough without believing in supernatural forces. I guess I'm like you. I never thought it was real."
"It's what the Ordos deal with," she said, unwrapping some dressings.
"I always thought the Ordos were autonomous secret police," he said. "You know, enforcing order, maintaining the imperial truth. All that talk of demonic forces, just propaganda to keep us all scared and in line."
"Well, the Inquisition is here," she said. "So I suppose we're dumb for not taking it seriously."
"Is it?"
he asked.
"What do you mean?" she asked.
Drusha shrugged his shoulders.
"I've been thinking about things," he said. "About all of this. You said they needed me because I was the only Magos biologist on Gershom. Not that I was the best, just that I was the only one..."
"Oh, don't start over," she sighed.
"No, hear me out," he replied. "This isn't self-pity. I may well be the only Magos biologist here, good or bad, but think about the case. This Eisenhorn has a ship, a crew, significant resources, technical specialists like that Jaff woman. He hears about the case here from off-world. He knows one of the victims is this woman he claims to know. He comes here. That's shift travel, a commitment of time and expense. But before he sets out for Gershom, he knew the victim, all the victims, had been mauled by animals. That was an established part of the case. He knew he'd need an expert, so I'm wondering, why didn't he bring one?"
She didn't answer.
"I mean, the Ordo must have plenty of specialists on staff," he went on. "Consultants they can call on at the drop of a hat. But he didn't bring one."
"Well, he thought he'd find one here."
"Yeah, a crappy one like me."
"If he got here and realized he needed specialist help, why didn't he signal to the Ordos to send someone? Someone really good. Like you said, Drusha, time. Time and expense." He shook his head.
"I don't buy it," he said.
"He comes unprepared, and he makes do with a has-been like me."
"Don't look at me like that. I know I'm no great shakes, Germaine. I'm not that deluded.
But he makes do." "The hell are you suggesting, Valentin?" she asked.
"I'm saying maybe he's not as connected as he wants us to think," said Drusha. "He and Vorier can flash all the badges they like and pretend to be all sorts of important things, but what if this isn't legitimate at all?"
"You mean? You don't think they're from the Ordos?"
"I'm saying that's possible. Or this whole thing is deeply unofficial. How do you people phrase it? A rogue operation. Sending for a high-level Magos biologist would have raised flags. I don't know if Master Eisenhorn is a real inquisitor or not, but I think what he's doing here is strictly off the record."
"I think you're paranoid," she replied.
"After last night, aren't you?"
She snapped the aid box shut. "Well, it's moot anyway," she replied.
The storm's cleared. The uplink is re-established. I'm going to contact the area governor this morning, establish an emergency situation, and ask him to mobilize the Territorial Guard. If the archenemy is here on Ankara, it needs to be contained, and this little group of ours isn't up to the task.
I don't think Eisenhorn's going to like that, said Drusha.
He can stick it up his ass for all I care, said Max. I'm magistratum, and I have a duty. He smiled at her.
That's what I always loved about you, Germaine.
What? She asked.
You, being you. Never backing down.
She grinned.
I did last night, she said.
Last night was different, he said.
Very,
she replied.
You were very different.
You faced that thing down.
You saved me.
I think that was Nail.
No, you kept it at bay. You didn't stop trying. Not like you at all.
Must be the mountain air.
She suddenly hugged him tight and planted a long, loud kiss on his cheek.
Thank you, she said.
She walked to the door. Oh, she added, turning to look back. Nail's cleaning out the mess in the parlor. The bones and stuff. They'll have to be quarantined. But there were some books you'd brought down from the library. I told Nail not to move them without checking with you. I didn't know if they were important.
Drusha went down to the parlor. He felt uneasy returning to the scene of the horror. Daylight made everything seem very ordinary, but he could still smell burned sawdust and cold decay. Nail, wearing surgical gloves, was scooping the brown bones into a hazard waste sack.
Books, he said when he saw Drusha. He pointed to a side table in the corner. Do you need them?
I might, said Drusha.
He walked over to the books and began to gather them up.
How did you kill it? He asked.
Headshot, said Nail.
You made it look easy, said Drusha.
Nothing easy about it.
I fired the riot gun at it multiple times. So did Max. No effect. It somehow neutralized the force of the shots.
Yeah, I heard you gave it a go. Good for you, Magus.
And that combat weapon of yours. You dumped some serious laz into it.
I did.
With no effect.
Yet a single bullet.
Nail looked up at him.
That thing, Magus, Nail said. It was an animation process. An energy form that had simply inhabited the dead bones. It was using them as a framework to move around in, to interact with the physical world.
I saw a shimmer on it, said Drusha. An aura, like an afterimage.
Right. So that energy form, it can just soak up kinetic damage from a pump gun or the high-yield las expended from my weapon.
And manipulate that energy to eat through doors. And people.
Correct.
But a single bullet, somehow.
It wasn't the bullet, said Nail. It was what was written on it. Eisenhorn etched it himself and gave me a stash of them. A charm, if you like an amulet. The charm broke the energy field and let the bullet do its damage.
Well, I'll take your word for that, Master Nail. It sounds a lot like hocus-pocus nonsense to me.
Me too,
said Nail.
But if hocus-pocus nonsense works, you go with it.
It sounds like this thing was created, said Drusha. I mean, artificially manufactured. And let out.
Nail rose to his feet.
You figured that out, did you?
He asked. The cold store door was unbolted, said Drusha. Max said so. The thing didn't eat its way out, and that's the only way it could have opened the door. So it follows that someone made it and let it out for a reason.
There's the makings of an investigator in you yet, sir, said Nail.
What was the reason? Asked Drusha.
To kill us all, said Nail.
That's my bet.
Because maybe we're getting too close to something. What happened last night could have happened any night in the week since we arrived. But it happened last night. So something happened yesterday that took us all a step too close to the truth. And you know what happened yesterday, Magus.
No, what?
You got here, said Nail.
That's not a very cheery notion, said Drusha.
Shall I tell you why I think there's more to you than meets the eye?
Asked Nail.
Why I think you've got that something that marks a good investigator. You don't ask the stupid questions.
Would they be? Asked Drusha.
Well, since we've been talking, you haven't once asked what it was.
I presume there wasn't a word for it, said Drusha. Or if there was, it would be part of a concept that was meaningless to me as a man of science.
That's pretty smart,
said Nail.
And you haven't asked who let it out.
"'Because I think you'd have told me if you knew,' said Drusha. "'Or it's classified, and there's no point asking in the first place.'
Drusha carried the small clutch of books back up the stairs to the library. They weren't significant, just essays on wildflowers and ornithology. He'd borrowed them to ease his mind, to refresh his thoughts with something familiar and reassuring. But they belonged in the library, so he was going to put them back there. You didn't borrow a fellow naturalist's books and not return them, even if that fellow naturalist was 30 years dead. He heard hammering from the basement. Max's deputies had been ordered to seal the cold store. The library was empty. The plastic sheeting on the windows rustled in the breeze. He started to slot the borrowed books back onto the shelves. The last one was the Book of Migration Patterns in the Carinine area. It had been the most interesting, clearly one of Fargal's favourites. The old man had filled the margins with pencilled annotations, remarks drawn from his observations of the seasonal influxes and exoduses. Those little jottings had been what Drusha had found most comforting. The marks of a man who had happily spent years wandering the hills in all weathers, witnessing the patterns of nature, noting unusual sightings, rare specimens, and the most likely sites for the observation of particular species. The handwritten notes gave Drusha a sense of kinship. He flipped through the pages one last time, before putting the book away, relishing the constant delight expressed in Fargal's notes. How the crosshammers always congregated along the same stretch of river each year, before beginning migration, gathering in such numbers the trees were bowed with them. How the forests rang with call and response in spring, when the exhausted redbeaks searched for their lifemates to reunite after the arduous voyage back. How the returning charhoops flocked at the pass in early summer, swarming and mobbing in huge clouds before continuing on up into the hills. Drusha paused. He read the note again. Surely. He flipped through the pages and speed-read some of the other annotations. The same thing several times. Could it be that simple? He put the book down and began to skim along the spines of the shelves. Geographic history. The origin of place names. He pulled out a volume or two and put them aside when they proved useless. He lighted on another and tried that instead. There it was. The text confirmed his idea. "Holy throne," he murmured. He took the geographic text and the annotated book and turned to hurry out. He stopped. He'd just noticed another book, tucked away at the end of the shelves.
"I'm sorry. That's simply not appropriate, Marshal," Eisenhorn was saying. He was sitting at the table in the main hall and looked more robust than he had the night before. Sleep had restored him, at least in part. Vorier and Jaff sat with him. They had been reviewing data slates together. Nail and Betancourt stood nearby. All of them were looking at Max, who was standing in the far end of the long table, Garofar at her side.
"Well, tough," said Max.
"Marshal, I'd watch your tone," said Vorier.
"I think what I'll watch, interrogator," replied Max, "is the welfare of the Imperial citizens in this province. The arch-enemy is abroad. I saw its handiwork with my own eyes. I'm going to contact the governor and declare an emergency, and I'm going to ask him for military support to—"
"We can deal with this, Marshal," said Vorier. "That's why we're here. This is our speciality. Leave it to us to make the decisions. Don't hinder us by complicating the situation."
"I have authority in this province," said Max.
"An authority superseded by the Ordos," replied Jaff. "Let's allow the governor to make that distinction," said Max. "He can overrule me. He may urge a territorial mobilization anyway to support your work. And, of course, he has the authority to request immediate clarification and authorization from the Office of the Inquisition on Brallant."
"I can't allow that," said Eisenhorn. "This matter is complex and sensitive. What you're suggesting will delay things and potentially place more people in harm's way."
"Are you asking me not to?" asked Max. "Or telling me not to? Or are you going to actually stop me doing it?"
"Cooperation would be the ideal remedy here," said Eisenhorn.
"I think that's good advice," said Drusha as he walked in. He dumped the three books on the table. "I think it's very good advice, and I think we should all take it."
"Magos, please," said Vorier. "This is a private briefing. The Marshal's already interrupted, and she was just about to leave.
"You recruited me to serve as an expert advisor," said Drusha, pulling out a chair and sitting down at the table. "Well, I have some expertise to share. I think, if you're really interested in the most efficient resolution of this matter, we could all start to cooperate. You're keeping Max and me in the dark, and I don't want any more crap about things being classified. Let's start sharing, shall we?"
Vorier and Jaff glanced at Eisenhorn. As ever, he was unreadable.
"What do you have, Magos?"
Eisenhorn asked quietly. Drusha waggled his finger.
"No, no," he said. "You show me yours, and I'll show you mine."
Garifar snorted. Max elbowed him. Eisenhorn sat back. He drummed his fingertips on the tabletop thoughtfully.
"Want me to clear the room, sir?" asked Nail.
"No, Harlan," said Eisenhorn.
"Take a seat, Marshal. You too, Deputy Garifar. My interrogator was just delivering new material. Now the storm's passed, the uplink is re-established. Vorier?"
Vorier looked at him anxiously.
"Sir, are you sure that—"
"Your report, please, interrogator."
Vorier cleared his throat and activated his data slate.
"Draven Sark," he said, reluctantly. "The local annals have no listing for anyone of that name. So it appears that Draven Sark was never a resident of or visited to Gershom. However, he is in the subsector census. Current age 251 standard, whereabouts unknown. A very high-ranking and respected Magos Medicae in his day. His grandfather is an interesting figure, a senior recollector in the Administratum. His name was Lemuel Sark, and he secured his footnote in history 4 centuries ago through his research on Symbol Iota, which led to a breakthrough in the battle against a virulent pestilence known as Ulrun's Pox."
"Also known as Budfroth, or the Torment," said Jaff. "It was a pandemic. Sark's work was crucial in containing—"
"I am familiar with the case," said Eisenhorn. "Sark was able to confirm that Ulrun's Pox was not a natural contagion or a Xenos plague, but in fact a weapon, deliberately bioengineered by a servant of the arch-enemy."
"Really?" asked Max.
Eisenhorn looked at her.
"That detail has been classified and withheld from the general population, Marshal. I've just unclassified it. So, Draven Sark is a descendant?"
"That's the case, sir," said Vorier. "The whole Sark family line has been engaged with Materia Medicae for many generations, either as Medicae experts or Medicae specialists serving the Administratum. In Draven Sark's case, the former. He retired decades ago."
"Whereabouts unknown?"
asked Eisenhorn.
"Yes," said Vorier. "But it appears he continued to practice on a private basis. In retirement, he assumed several identities. Sadrain Karnak, Filippo Bosk, Ement Pellet."
"Why does a respected Medicae take on assumed names?" asked Max.
Vorier smiled.
"The circumstances of his retirement are sealed," he said. "One may presume malpractice and the quiet effort to avoid scandal. Draven Sark and his various alter egos have been persons of interest to both the Arbites and the Ordos at different times over the last century. He had a history of unfortunate associations. Nothing that could lead to prosecutions, but enough to convince me he walks in the shadows of lawlessness."
Vorier scrolled through his slate.
"Some 70 years ago," he said, "Filippo Bosk was listed as a resident of Gershom, specifically of Ankara province. He owned property here, paid his tithes, was listed as retired."
"Where were his properties?" asked Eisenhorn.
"Unknown," said Vorier. "A great number of municipal records were lost during the Civil War. All trace of Filippo Bosk vanished about 20 years ago. But we have pics of him, and comparative recognition cogitation confirms within an error margin of decimal 0.002% that Bosk and Sark are the same man."
"So he disguises his identity, but not well," said Betancourt. "A simple verification reveals the truth. That seems clumsy."
"Or suggests that Bosk, or Sark, or whatever he wanted to call himself, felt secure," replied Eisenhorn. "That he was confident he could not be found, even if someone was looking."
"If he lived here," said Drusha, "then he was happy to be known to his neighbors,
neighbours like Essek Fargul by his real name.
Which reinforces my point, said Eisenhorn. His neighbours knew his real name. He entertained and was not a recluse. He had influence and an influential circle of friends. The name of his property was known. Keshter. Yet neither it nor he can be located. His disguise was casual, Medea, because he was clearly able to hide very well.
You should look at his list of known associates, sir, said Vorier, sliding the data slate towards his senior. An influential circle of friends indeed. Artists, administratum officials, men of science, senior military officers, at least one ex-governor of Gershom.
You see my urge for confidence now, Marshal?
Eisenhorn asked Max.
That name in the third column there, sir, said Vorier, pointing to the slate. That was the one that caught my eye.
Goran Koblika, said Eisenhorn.
Who's that? Asked Drusha.
A recidivist, said Eisenhorn. A man pursued for years by the Order Hereticus. A suspected member of the Cognite. And the man that Thea Inchibel was looking for when she came here.
What is the Cognite? Asked Max.
Some things must remain classified, said Eisenhorn. The point is, we have a connection. A link between the elements. Sark resided in the Carinines. Thea's remains and the others were discovered in the area. Sark knew the man Thea was hunting. He may have offered sanctuary to his friend Koblika, especially if his home was somehow impossible to detect.
Perhaps not so impossible, said Drusha. Eisenhorn stared at him.
Jaff and Vorier looked taken aback.
My turn, said Drusha. When I encountered Essek Fargul in the woods yesterday, however I encountered him, he said that Kestra was a fortress near here, but down towards the pass.
So you said, said Vorier.
We presumed he meant the Karad Pass, north of here. So that's the area we've been looking at, said Drusha.
And there's nothing here, said Max. Drusha opened the old man's annotated text.
Fargul was a keen observer, he said. See how he made notes, the little things he noticed. He also knew a good deal about local history. His family had lived here for a long time. In these margin comments, he uses the phrase the pass several times. I didn't notice it at first, because I assumed he meant Karad. But here, if you look, he refers to flocks massing at the pass before moving up into the hills. So? Asked Jaff. If they were massing at the pass, said Drusha, they would already be in the hills. Karad is north of us, deep in the range. He meant somewhere else. To Essek Fargul, the pass was something else.
Drusha pushed the annotated text aside and opened the geographical history.
In fact, he said, it's so obvious it's a little embarrassing. Here, Ankara is derived from the old Fent word for crossroads. Ankara town is a crossroads, because it was founded on the best navigational transit point south of the Carinines. It is a major pass between the Carinine foothills and the southern uplands. A more significant pass than Karad, in fact. We don't think of it that way, because there's a town there now. But to an older local man like Fargul, that would be the pass, and would require no further clarification.
So we've been looking in the wrong area, asked Vorier.
Drusha nodded. I believe we have. Keshtri is not north of us, towards Karad. It's south of us, towards Ankara town.
Audla Jaff sniffed.
Interesting, she said. But if that's what you have to share, Magos, it's comparatively minor. You have used a paltry scrap of expertise to leverage far more information from us.
Well, said Drusha, that's what good investigators do, isn't it, Master Nail? I think, said Nail, covering his amusement. We should go back to the maps and see what's south of us.
There's nothing south of us either, said Jaff, annoyed. Actually, I think there is, said Drusha. I hadn't finished, Mamsel Jaff. I happened upon this, too.
He put the third book in front of him. It was an old volume of a larger format, its green card cover faded by the years.
This was in the library, said Drusha. It's Essek Fargul's sketchbook.
He was carrying it the day I met him.
Yesterday,
Nail reminded him. Whatever day yesterday was, Master Nail, said Drusha. He opened the book. Its pages were age-spotted and frail. Many loose leaves and sheets of paper had been stuffed into it, held between the covers by the tie ribbon. Drusha turned over drawings of the deep valley, of trees, of pools and tumbled stones, overgrown. He liked this country, said Drusha. He drew it a lot. Sometimes the same location, over and over. He liked the river. He also liked the old fortresses. He made many studies of them, especially the ruined ones. Look at this. He pushed one sketch onto the table so they could all see it. It showed two broken stones in a woodland clearing. The note at the bottom says, Balian Fortress. It's clearly nothing more than a few stones. But to Fargul, it was a fortress still. Balian is not on any of the maps, but it is listed in the indices of several histories as a Carinine fort. So, Fargul, with his love of local lore, knew the old sites even when published history had forgotten them. Now, look at this one. Drusha spread the sketchbook open. It was a fine graphite sketch of a mountain pool, fed by three brooks and overhung on the rising side by huge blocks of tumble-down stone, swathed in moss. I watched him draw this, said Drusha. It's where I met him. Eisenhorn got up and limped around the table to Drusha's side. He hunched over, one hand on the tabletop, and studied the sketch. Your auto-seancer, said Drusha. It did not conjure the old man from his grave at random. It conjured him to tell me something important. I just didn't know what until now. See what he wrote beneath the drawing?
Ruins beside pool, Eisenhorn read out. Kestry Watch Gate.
I thought the old stones were a southern watchtower for Helter, said Drusha, tapping the picture. But they are, in fact, a northern watchtower of Kestra.
This was in the library all along? Asked Eisenhorn.
Yes, said Drusha. Sark really was Fargul's neighbour.
Eisenhorn straightened up. For a second he placed his hand on Drusha's shoulder. Drusha wasn't sure if the Inquisitor was simply seeking support as he rose, or if he was fleetingly expressing some form of appreciation.
This was in the library all along, he repeated.
He was looking at Audler Jaff.
I thought you'd been through every book in the library, Mam Jaff, asked Garifar.
I hadn't got to every single volume, said Jaff sharply. She restrained herself. I was working methodically. There were still 100 or so volumes to be assessed. I clearly hadn't got to that one yet.
She looked at Eisenhorn.
My sincere apologies, sir, she said. You know my work to be thorough, and—
Eisenhorn raised his hand.
Never mind, he said. Let's find the house this ruined gate belongs to.
Chapter 13 Gates of Kestra. Drusha buttoned up his old coat and wandered into the yard to join the others. It was late morning, and the sun was out. Most of the party were checking their walking gear or their weapons. Eisenhorn stood apart, talking to Betancourt. As he approached, Drusha overheard the end of their conversation.
I still say you need to rest and leave this to Vorier, Betancourt was saying.
Not an option, Medea.
Then at least give me a few hours to find a decent ATV to—
I can walk. The ground is too steep and the forest too dense for a vehicle.
Then I'll walk with you every step of the way.
No, Eisenhorn said. I want you at the landing zone, prepped. We may have need of heavier support.
Gregor, we don't have the sort of heavy support that—
I know we don't have him, Medea. Throne knows I wanted to bring him, but these days he's too wayward. It would have taken all my effort just to keep him in line. We'll have to manage without.
Medea Betancourt glared at her master uncertainly, then noticed Drusha approaching.
Magus, she nodded.
She looked back at Eisenhorn.
I'll see you later, she said.
They left the gatehouse and walked downrange into the forest. The sun had raised a mist from the forest floor, and it fumed like smoke through the glades. Max and her deputies led the way in a loose line, followed by Nail and Varier, with Eisenhorn, Jaff, and Drusha bringing up the rear. The progress was leisurely, mainly held back by the speed of the Inquisitor's progress.
"'You didn't have to accompany us, Magos,' said Jaff. "'Well, I feel I've come this far,' replied Drusha, lightly. "'I'd like to see the rest.' "'Do you know what the rest is?' she asked. "'No, ma'am, which is why I want to see it. "'A man should sometimes be careful about what he wants,' said Jaff.
Jaff moved on ahead, leaving Drusha to keep pace with Eisenhorn. "'She's right,' Eisenhorn said. "'You may regret this, Magos.'
"'Because it's going to be dangerous, sir?'
"'Yes,' said Eisenhorn. "'There is a chance you won't survive the experience. "'Or worse.'
"'There's a worse?'
"'Always. "'That you may survive it, and wish you hadn't. "'That the memories will haunt you for the rest of your days.'
"'A redbeak trilled in a nearby tree. "'Tell me about the case,' said Drusha.